So we've had the French. The French is done and dusted, and we had a little bit of a delay.
What? We're moving on. Not going to talk about it. French is done.
We're not going to talk about the French. So that happened. Everybody, welcome to... No, I was going to say that there was a little bit of a delay for our look back pod. Because firstly, it's you and I trying to coordinate our life these days, which is actually really hard. And secondly, you've been a little bit under the weather, so you wouldn't have really had a voice. It would have been like a 5 minute sort of look back pod, right?
I mean, a little bit under the weather is an understatement. It was. I'm in full feel sorry for myself mode. I worked on the French, and we had so much fun. It was an absolute blast. I had some epics. I had some real epics. That's what happens when when you're on court, Suzanne Longland. Most of the time,
you had. Did you have Haddad Maia?
I had Haddad Maia. Yes. So that was one of the longest matches of all time.
And that rolled into the second one.
And then
you had 8 hours.
Was five sets. Yeah, exactly. So it was about eight and a half.
Yes, that day.
Plus we'd done a bit of build-up. So it was all in all, give or take, around nine-ish on air. And obviously we're on a digital stream, so there's no breaks. You're talking every sit down and you just...
And then
just
hang
go.
On. Did you swap over to another team when Świątek came off and... Lesia Sorenko retired and they were on court for about 20 minutes.
Yes. And by the time I was home, that next team messaged me going, Sorenko retired. It's very funny. But yeah, so I had some epic days. Anyway, the long and short of it was that by the end, I was struggling a little bit, and I ended up with tonsillitis over the weekend. So that has been horrendous. If anyone who's had tonsillitis, you know what it's like. It is just
awful.
But
hang on a sec. What I don't understand is we basically stay in contact with voice notes, which you've just discovered. I don't know where you've been.
I honestly have.
What you've been doing.
In the last 3 weeks, I've just started voice noting people. It's so good.
Where have you been?
This is what I do, though. I come to trends and fashions very, very late.
Wow! this is great. So then, I'd normally send you one on my walk past the Parc de Princes, PSG Stadium, all the way to work, because that was like my window. I realised I had one window a day to call someone or to leave basically a podcast length voice note for someone, and that was it. So I'd send you one. And you'd send one back, and I'd try and listen to it at work. If not, I'd listen to it on the way back. And one of them, I was horrified. I was walking back. It was about midnight. And you were telling me about your tonsillitis, which was bad enough. But then you said, and I still can't understand this, that you took a photo or you looked at your own tonsils and saw what was going on in there. And I still don't understand how you do that or why you do that. How do you... Yeah.
Well, I did it because I suspected I had tonsillitis, and you need to look at your tonsils to see if you have tonsillitis because they change colour. And you're trying to do it now with a phone. You need to use a mirror. It's a combination of a mirror and a phone camera, and then you can have a look at your tonsils.
But you can
not like that. But you can. You can get a good old look in there, and it was a mess.
And I'm sorry, but I'm walking back. It's around midnight, so you're keeping an eye what's around you. It's a lovely neighbourhood, but you're keeping an eye. And I'm hearing this. It was like being in some kind of horror movie. So it's pitch black. I'm walking along. I'm looking left and right. You're describing stuff on your tonsils. And I'm thinking, A, how did you look at them? Which you've now told me it's a couple of things. B, I'm like, why would you do that? Just let the doctor do that. Why did you do that? It's horrible.
Well, I had a look just to see what was going on. And anyway, doctor did confirm it was absolutely tonsillitis. Another highlight from our voice notes was when I was recording one and I was going past a billboard, and on the billboard was an advert, and it had Casper Ruud on it. And I just got so excited because I was just so surprised to see Casper Ruud standing there. It was an advert for Samsonite luggage, which I guess is one of his sponsors.
Makes sense. Travels a lot.
And he's standing there holding his racket in his nice sort of studio dark room, but with like good lighting on him, doing his modelling thing. And it's not like he was there because there's Wimbledon or anything. He's just there on the Samsonite campaign at the bottom of my road.
Well, what made me laugh was not that you don't get excited often, but like normally, normally voice notes during a Grand Slam have a certain tone. We're normally very, very tired. They're normally being sent in the morning or the evening.
A little bit delirious,
slightly kind of, oh, but The joy in your voice as I listen. I can remember exactly where I was. I was just crossing the traffic lights from my hotel. I started laughing because the joy in your voice as you described seeing Casper Ruud on the Samsonite advert. You was like, wow, and there was Casper Ruud. I was like, okay. But maybe, as you said, maybe it was delirium. Maybe that was your delirious phase, right?
Yeah, and that in the... it was definitely in a bit of delirium, and when I had those, I had Haraj Maia, and then it was Runa after that, and in his 5-set match, I hit a real point of just being completely delirious when so many people I knew messaged me who were watching, and some people later on who were watching on like catching up later were just cracking up because I just was hysterically laughing because we were getting shots of Patrick Mouratoglou in the box telling Runa to step in on the return, saying go forward, step in on the return. Like, you could see what he was saying. He was speaking in English and certainly was making his signals as he does. It's quite clear. So for a couple of points I was saying yeah, so Patrick just really wants him to step in. Played another point, then he went to return again. And I was like, no, he still wants him to be in more than that. And so that was sort of the talking point. And then it cut to the next point. And at this point, Runa had got pretty stroppy. And he just looked at Patrick. And then he just walked as far back to the back of the court as he could and did a full Daniil Medvedev return position of like 7 metres behind the baseline. And I was just absolutely, I laughed so hard. And I think it probably, I did turn my microphone off because I was laughing too hard. But if I left my microphone on for about 3 points, I was just giggling. So I just thought it was so funny that we'd just done this whole big thing of like, yeah, so he's got to step in. That's what Patrick wants him to do. That's what he's trying to do. And then he was literally just like, piss off, Patrick. Oh, that was my favourite highlight. But as I say, you have to add in a lot of, that was like maybe the 8th hour of commentary we were doing. Seventh, eighth hour. It was quite late in the day.
Every now and then. And I was at that point getting the TV show ready for the evening. So I write all the highlights and I had all these gaps. Is that match going to be finished? Is that going to be on? What's going to be on court? And every now and then I'd look up on my WhatsApp and they'd do a message and you go, no, it's still going. And I had the TV on in the office and I was kind of watching it and writing. I just thought, Christ, you are still talking. And I think, yeah, and then obviously the next match doesn't last very long. That's over and it was like, yeah, okay, that's... So it was like 8 hours of tennis that put everything behind and then it kind of caught up with itself, which was... It's crazy, isn't it?
Already... It was so much fun, though. They were good matches and we really enjoyed them. So like we'd at the end, we were exhausted, but we were like, we've had a great time. I was alongside Barry Cowan for that, so yeah, we had a good time.
Yeah, you get those matches and they're long, but you get into them and they're great fun, but you're exhausted at the end, you're just slightly delirious, which is when, as I say, you and I spent a lot of our time communicating. If we published any of those voice notes, you get excited about Casper. Do you want to start in the men's draw then, as you got excited about Casper and his Samsonite suitcase?
Excellent, let's do it. Yes, what do you want me to say? No, that one I picked. Yay. I picked both winners. That's what I'm saying.
Did you? Yeah,
I'm pretty sure I did.
Again, it's well done, but you didn't go out on a limb, did you? But well done.
No, but that wasn't the task. It wasn't pick a dark horse or an outsider. It was pick the winner.
Yeah, so
well done me.
I didn't get either, did I? No. I went Alcaraz and Sabalenka, didn't I?
Did you? Or did you?
Or Rybakina? No. No. I think for... No. I would have... No, I don't.
Can I just say the history of this podcast? We've been going for years now. Predictions have been shocking,
awful.
As in, even awful. Flipping a coin would be better awful. Than listening to us, right? And particularly me. However, this French Open, I think it all came good because I went out on a limb and I said there is no chance Daniil Medvedev is winning the French Open. He lost
yes,
in the first
did.
Round.
Yes, you did.
I said that Coco is not going to be able to stand up to the very best players in the world, and that's exactly what we saw. Like, she did well until that point, And I picked Świątek and Djokovic as winners. I need to retire now.
Oh, very good. From the podcast, thanks. From predictions, or from everything? Have we just made an announcement that I knew nothing about? this is it. We're never going to predict again. No, I was... my predictions... Okay, this is where we dive into this. We could, because there's a couple of talking about it. We're starting with the men's. There's a couple of talking about it. I do want to talk about Alcaraz and what happened there. I think Casper Ruud, I think what he's doing is phenomenal. Three finals in the last five Grand Slams. No, he hasn't crossed the finish line yet, but look, he's four in the world. He's 24 years of age. He's doing so well, and I do believe he's going to get there. He didn't have a lot of form in the early part of this year. Won Estoril, came into form at the right time, got to the final. So I think for Casper Ruud, phenomenal tournament once again. For Djokovic, I mean, look, he's tied with Serena Williams now at 23. He's the all-time leading man with 23. He's the only man to have won at least three of each of the slams. I mean, it's, you know, I think he made this point, didn't he, to his team in his speech. Sorry if I've been awful, or words to that effect. Because there's history. And, you know, there was a telling moment for me that we, working with the FFT, we sometimes get interviews with the finalists after their final practice. Just literally, hey, feeling, you ready to go? And so Casper Ruud did his, and he was like, oh, it's such an honour, it's great. And like, you're very nice, you know, could imagine him with a Samsonite suitcase, being very happy and lovely. And then Djokovic, you know, blah, 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 fine. Like, then the question was, you know, how do you relax because there's so much on the line, like history? And we remember what happened in 2021, right? At the Olympics, when initially it was the Golden Slam, and then the US Open. And he gave polite but short, sharp shrift to the reporter. It's not special, it's nothing on the line, it's fine, bye. And then you could tell it's there, isn't it? He wants to make history. He wants to break records. He wants to go into the history books. And he was dealing, okay, he had never lost to Ruud and he'd won eight straight sets, but he was dealing with his own inner chatting about what he could achieve. And I think, again, he just stood up to it and did what he does.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I think particularly going into the Alcaraz match, into the semi-final, because everybody hyping up Alcaraz, understandably so, I get it. I mean, some of the stuff that he
pulled
off. Did
you see him play against Tsitsipas? I mean, I've just gone off on a tangent. Yeah. We had Alex Krejcik in the box next to us, who kept looking through the glass, literally, with his jaw on the floor, could not process what he had just seen. And at one point, Krejcik actually came into our commentary box saying, is this really happening? I mean, it was astonishing. But yes.
Yeah, but it's basic. The thing is that this is the test, right? This is why the top guys have really stifled everybody else, because it's about, can you do that on the big stage, best of five sets against somebody of the level of Djokovic over and over and over again? And you knew that Djokovic was just going to produce a very good level. Look, if they had both played the best tennis that we saw from them in the tournament, Alcaraz wins comfortably, of course. And yeah, I think if they both play their best tennis, Alcaraz wins comfortably. Like, you know, but that's not what the question is. The question is, can you win today? Can you do it today? And can you do it? And, you know, I know he had the cramping and everything, but we're just talking about Djokovic for the moment. But that is the ultimate test. And yes, it used to be Nadal at Roland Garros, and it's been Djokovic everywhere else. You know, and that is, it shows you how Alcaraz is a phenomenon, you know, everything that he does, but that is still a step away. That's how hard it is to these guys have completely shut everybody out. I mean, nobody's even had a thought of really winning apart from on a very off day. But if Djokovic is going to deliver a decent to good, like a good level, it's so incredibly difficult. Incredibly difficult. You know, I mean, we saw in the final against Ruud, like, I mean, that first set was just so brutal. I know the temperatures and stuff were tough as well, but like, it was so brutal. You were just thinking, I mean, what does Casper do? I mean, okay, you could, you know, go again, lift the level or whatever. Of course he fell away because, I mean, it was just ridiculous. You can't even win a set like that. And of course the tie breaks that Djokovic produced in the tournament were flawless. But that's the challenge. That's what they've always done. That's what Federer's always done. That's what Nadal's always done. That's what Djokovic has always done. In terms of those three, the challenge is so ridiculous. And to look at somebody like Alcaraz, who is better than anybody else that we've had for a very long time, you know, and he is, any of the other players that have been on the cusp or might have nicked a slam here and there or won a few, like Stan and Andy, you know, I'm even, you know, his ceiling is so much higher, and he is better than them. But it is just such a phenomenal, it's a big mountain. Like, sure, he won the US Open, but that's different, you know. So I don't know, it's for me, going into the match, I was thinking, well, right, now let's see, can he deliver it point after point after point? Because it had been a little bit more erratic from him through the tournament. There'd obviously been some amazing stuff. But you just knew Djokovic was going to ask that of him and ask that of Ruud in the final. And I think Ruud fell quite short. Who knows whether Alcaraz would have fallen short without cramping, but unfortunately that's part of it. It's dealing with the occasion. And Djokovic rolls into Wimbledon as the comfortable favourite.
34th Grand Slam final, 7th at Roland Garros, now 3 Roland Garros titles, 23 Grand Slam singles titles. I mean, the numbers, the records are ridiculous. I was actually asked at the airport on the way home, how many Grand Slam titles do I think Novak Djokovic will end on? And I'm getting a number for you as well. I've gone 26.
Yeah. It's tough, isn't it?
Because 24, he's got to get to 25 to break the record. So he's on 23. Margaret Court's 24, so he's definitely going to be gunning for 25. And I've 26. Because the others are coming, the others are learning. That the US Open is still, that you do get some different strange results, different winners. I think Roland Garros is not going to be as straightforward. So yeah, what number would you like to put on it?
Well, I had the same conversation because I think that's what most people were really talking about, weren't they? But I went with 25.
Okay.
I think 25. I mean, look, it's totally possible that he could be pushing up way higher than this, but, you know, you do have Carlos really coming. Like, Carlos he's not that far away. And in actuality, he's already got a lot of the boxes ticked in terms of his level is good enough. We know that he can deliver it. It's now just about delivering it every single time and in those particular situations. So, you know, I can't see what happened in the semi-final with him cramping and having to just, you know, bow out like that. I mean, it's not going to happen again, is it?
Well, you'd like to think not. But let's talk about the cramping, because it's... And how it was dealt with and how it's allowed to be dealt with and the rules and why it happened. And he was very honest afterwards, basically saying, you know, the nerves, the occasion, facing like someone like Novak Djokovic. But then how can you say it won't happen if, for instance, he was facing Novak Djokovic in the final of Wimbledon, if it comes down to mental side of things? Because it's not necessarily, it affects you physically, but it seems to have come largely mentally, from the mental side of things.
Yeah, it's stress and nerves and anxiety. It's absolutely exhausting. You're tense. You'll be tense all day. You'll be tense probably from the night before. You probably slept a bit tense, you know, and it all just builds and builds. And, you know, and he was really uptight through that first set and a bit, wasn't he, really? And it took him a little bit of time to settle. And then it wasn't long before then the cramping kicked in. So the damage was done. No, I think... I just don't think it will happen again. He'll just learn to manage the stress, learn to manage the nerves better, because you're not going to be as nervous now, because, you know, when you're nervous and you're anxious, you're always thinking about, like, you know, the worst case scenario. I think the worst case scenario happened, really.
Yeah.
He completely broke down and fell apart, which has never happened to him. Physicality has never been a question for him at all. So that must have been the biggest shock to the system. You know, that would be very humbling, you know, very difficult for him to deal with. But he will deal with it. And, yeah, I just don't think he's going to be as nervous now, because he's going to... If, say, he plays him in the final of Wimbledon, he's going to say, well, what's the worst that can happen? I've already had to cramp and roll over one time. Like, yeah, but it surely can't get worse than that.
Yeah, but surely the worst that can happen is that happening again. Because I know we talk about managing stress and there'll be ways that they'll look at. But, I mean, because you've got to think that he ate everything correctly.
Yeah, but the first time, I know what you're saying, but the first, like, as in, this is something that Alcaraz would never have even considered happening.
No, no.
Juan Carlos Ferreira would have never considered the fact that after... When did he actually start cramping? Two sets in?
Yeah, after in the third set. The,
just not
the
even
at the end of the
that.
Second game of the third set, because then he conceded the third game at the beginning of his serve.
Yeah. So the number one thing they would be saying to him before the match is that physically you're leagues above Djokovic right now, which he is. You know, like, you know, physically, don't worry about it. Make it as tough as it is, as tired as you feel, as much as you've got to suffer, just know that you are absolutely wearing him down and you can beat him physically over best of five. Yeah. That's what they would have believed. So then all of a sudden, you know, cramping is about fatigue, it's about stress, it's about lack of preparation. It's all things that are manageable, which is why you're not allowed to receive treatment for it. Because the argument from players is that if I have worn down my opponent enough, that they start cramping, that I should receive the benefit for that. They shouldn't be able to have a massage and have some time off and like time out and stop cramping and then be able to continue on. You know, I've beaten them physically. They can't last very long because it is to do with preparation, having enough hydration, salts, all that sort of stuff. That's about being professional. And then about just physically dealing with stuff. So that's the reason why you aren't allowed to have medical timeouts for it. However, you then have the flip side of tennis as a sport. You don't want Carlos to pull out. I mean, he couldn't step on his leg to begin with. So you want them to receive some treatment, but for the benefit of the opponent, you don't want them to have a medical timeout and actually impact the match and the flow of the match. So the happy medium, which is what, happy, unhappy, I don't know, but the medium that they found, the compromise is that you get treatments at the change of ends, which is why we saw obviously Carlos concede so that he could concede that game so he could go to the change of ends, and he had what, two treatments at the change of ends, and that's what you're allowed. And look, he was able to finish the match, so it's sort of a win-win because Djokovic, you know, this is how the rule is supposed to work. Djokovic got the benefit of the fact that his opponent was not fit enough, but the crowd got to see the end of the match because Carlos was able to somewhat play.
And I think it looked more dramatic to some, especially those in the stadium, because it was the beginning of the third game. He had to concede the whole game. And I think that's why people felt, you know, if there was maybe a point in it or one point to go, it wouldn't have been, oh, he's just conceded a point, the way people were looking at it, because it was the whole game. People were like, what?
And it was a service game as well. It was a break. Like, that was set done, potentially. Yeah.
And it was interesting. I was looking at, I was commentating on the match. And I was looking on social media, and Andy Roddick was really interesting. He was kind of giving kind of blow by blow of what was going on, and it's cramping, it's this. And he basically said it's done now. He said it's done.
You can't play at the right level again.
Can't.
He was able to get enough treatment that he could finish the match, but it wasn't a good level.
I have to say, from our cross, I spoke to a couple of the British journalists, and they really applauded his honesty, and he basically came into the press conference, and not that he could necessarily hide it, but he was really, really honest with what happened and the fear and the nerves and going out there. He's great, isn't he? He's great for the game. He's great for everything. The smile on his face, his openness. I did some fun things with him at the start of the tournament for the FFT. And he's a great character. And he came in and he was very honest. And as you said, he's going to learn from it. He will hope it won't happen again. Hopefully it won't happen again. It's I guess he's aware of it now, right? So he's aware that that is a possibility. So it's something that will be factored maybe a little bit more consciously into preparations for big matches like that.
Yeah, and he's really not had anything not go his way since he burst onto the scene, to be honest. He's absolutely flown up. He's improved so much. He's had a lot of niggling injuries. He's had to pull out of a lot of tournaments. So I know that but a lot of that is managing. It's not necessarily like, oh, I can't physically play a match. A lot of it is you're playing a lot. You seem to be winning most tournaments you're playing. So that means you're going deep, and you know, a lot of it will be a choice from the camp to say, right, let's not play next week. I've got a bit of a sore stomach. Let's rest next week. It's not really an ab tear, although I'm sure he did have strains at a certain point. But you know what I mean. It's not necessarily as bad as it seems. He's just managing the body. But yeah, I mean, another learning curve. We remember Andy Murray. You know, he cramped. In matches. You know, it wasn't plain sailing for, you know, I think all of the top guys. I think probably the only one it was plain sailing for was Federer, maybe.
Yeah. possibly. Maybe. Yeah.
I mean, Djokovic had a bit few dips to begin
early
with.
Early stages of his career with allergies, not finishing matches, and mentioned in passing that Alcaraz's performance against Tsitsipas. Can we just now mention Stefanos Tsitsipas and Paola Badosa? Who, I mean, not only are they apparently a couple, but they're putting it out there for the world to see. I mean, it felt like it came from nowhere and suddenly he's everywhere.
I know. They seem so happy, don't they? They look like they're obsessed with each other. That's so nice.
I had a couple of my friends were going to work at a paddle tournament in Dubai, and they sent me a message and they said, we're just at the airport and we've seen Tsitsipas and Badosa being very touchy-feely and affectionate in the middle of Dubai airport. Well, they just arrived. And they hadn't seen or heard. At this point, we'd sort of seen and heard about it. So I wasn't as surprised as if that had just suddenly come out of the blue. But it's kind of everywhere. But then I guess it's good if you stick it out there. It's not some secretive thing that people are talking about. It's just, I mean, as you say, good luck to them. Congratulations to
good
them.
For them.
And maybe that eased his pain a little bit of that defeat by Alcaraz. I mean, that was genuinely just watching some of that tennis going... Genuinely. And again, with Alex Krejci, just kept looking and going. And he was just like, he just like shrugging his shoulders. And I mean, that's astonishing. I mean,
and you're
was,
like, this guy's been in the final.
I just, yeah. And he was like, and I was, it's astonishing. The women's side of things, we had some lovely, well, there were some nice stories. Alina Svitolina, I mean, look, I'm not an athlete. It was hard enough getting back in shape after having the boys. But for her, she gave birth to Sky, I think, October. And then to win, she won Strasbourg in the lead up to it. And then to go on the run she did. And the way she plays, it's never going to be easy. You know, she's got to fight. She's got to stay out there. She's got to move. I thought with that one win from Gael Monfils before he had to pull out with his wrist, I thought that was one of those really lovely stories, seeing what Svitolina was doing.
Yeah. It really was a massive highlight, wasn't it, of the tournament? It was just so great. What I loved is to see her different perspective. And, you know, she talked about it a little bit, that she was always stressed about points and about maintaining a ranking and, you know, always, you know, winning for a certain reason, I suppose, and competing for a certain reason. And actually, this time just felt like she was on court just playing for herself. And for her family, I guess. And I'm sure she's learnt a lot of that from Gael as well. Felt like she was sort of adopted a little bit by the French crowd. you know, if she's good enough for Gael, she's good enough for the French crowd, surely. And it's just nice. And I mean, I always love watching Svitolina when she's playing at her best. Like, it's just, it's so feisty. It's just all about competitiveness. She just doesn't have the natural abilities, the natural power, the natural, you know, everything really. You know, even the movement, I don't think it's that natural. I think that she is an example of somebody who is just so competitive, so driven, and has just absolutely maximised what she's got.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't think that you're looking at her as a junior going, oh, she's talented. You know, you're going, gosh, she's competitive and she'll do whatever it takes to win. And she's made this happen and she's been a phenomenal player. Like, oh, she's great.
Yeah, I thought that was really lovely. They were actually staying at our hotel, but I didn't really see that many people because I was never really there. I left early, came back very, very late. Saw Monfils the evening when he just held a press conference to say he couldn't go on. Saw Jannik Sinner when he was checking out, when he'd just been knocked out. Saw a lot of Leila Fernandez and her sister, because she obviously got through to the doubles final with Taylor Townsend. That's a lovely pairing, isn't it? So I saw her. And then, do you remember Leslie Bowery, French Open champion of years gone by? Leslie's lovely, Australian. Used to work with Leslie and Bill at Wimbledon years ago. On my last day, I was sitting in reception. I couldn't find an Uber. No Ubers in Paris Monday after Roland Garros. Just none. And I was sitting there thinking, gosh, I was very calm. But I was thinking, gosh, I might actually miss my plane at this point. And then I saw Leslie Bowery walk past. And I said, Leslie, how are you? She said, great. Haven't seen you. Da, da, da. What are you doing? I said, well, I'm trying to find a taxi at the moment. She said, come with us. Because she had a tournament car. And then the man arrived and he said, oh, Leslie, former champion, I am delighted to take you to the airport.
Oh, and nice.
She'd come over with her daughter and she said that the French treat former champions beautifully. You know, there's meals, there's events, there's tennis. She said it's such a wonderful experience coming back to Roland Garros every year because they look after the former champions so well. And she said it's absolutely, so it's really lovely. So she drove me to the airport. We got a lovely catch up, got to meet her daughter, talk about working together in the years gone by at Wimbledon, those days. That was really nice. Sorry, I've just gone on a complete tangent, but that was...
you got your flight.
I got my flight, and that was a little bit about a hotel where Ina Svitolina was staying. When it came to Iga Świątek, who turned 22, she got tiramisu and that massive Colosseum Lego kit that just made me start shaking because the amount of Lego kits, and you're going to get there with baby Rog that you put together and you miss a piece and they don't work. I don't know how Świątek can find it soothing or satisfying, because if I never saw another piece of Lego again, it'd be too soon.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to Lego.
Oh, you say it. Yeah. You say it. You're all like bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
I know.
But when he loses a piece, when you tread on it in the middle of the night when you go into the bathroom, when it doesn't work because you've missed a piece, there'll be none of this. I'm looking forward to Lego. None. You know, the boys' birthday
enough.
Parties this weekend.
Yes.
And the mothers were saying, can I have some present ideas? I was like, no Lego. And a couple of the mums work for Lego. I was like, please don't give us any Lego. So, sorry, I've gone off again at one. But, yes, Iga Świątek, we did ask, actually, Courtney Nguyen asked on behalf of us if she'd started the Colosseum. And she said, no, because I'll probably lose pieces. I can't do it yet. She was focusing on doing what she does so well, and that is getting to Grand Slam finals and winning them.
Yeah, she just overwhelmed everyone, didn't she?
She's very good at that, isn't she?
That's that.
Just getting there. She's dropped her first set in a final, but she just, gosh, she's good, isn't she?
Yeah, pretty much. Just ridiculously good. I mean, she, you know, she overwhelms people with how quickly she plays, how aggressive she is with her positioning on the court. She gets that little bit of extra time on the clay, which is very important, especially against the bigger hitters, because they don't overwhelm her. But she didn't really play that many bigger hitters this time. You know, she didn't play against Sabalenka. Rybakina had to pull out as well. So, you know, she was sort of... It would have been interesting to see what would have happened against them. But I think, would have favoured her because of just a little bit of extra time she would have got. She would have been able to rush them. And you know what she does? She stands inside the baseline in the very middle, and she just goes corner to corner, and she just melts it, just side to side to side. I mean, for most players, it takes two of those to win. Against the better players, it would take three, maybe four. But ultimately, she just does. It's phenomenal to see. So yeah, amazing, really. Fourth slam. So I think it would be different, though. It'd be interesting to say on the grass, the bigger hitters will be a bit more suited. I don't think she's the favourite at Wimbledon.
No, I think we said the same last year, didn't we? We didn't have a... And I'm not saying we got our predictions right, because we don't. But she definitely wasn't one of our picks. And Caroline Mukova, her coach, has actually just come out recently saying that she was suffering from the same thing as Rybakina, the allergy, the heavy chest, the tightness. But the doctor said she could play, but it would be harder. And I think that the sort of takeaway from Mukova is it's so great that she plays a lovely brand of tennis. She doesn't have that one big shot, but she's got lots of weapons, which she said is a good thing, it's a bad thing. But I really like how she plays. She seems to stay very calm. I don't know what she's like. She doesn't give a lot away. And isn't it great, though, that she's fit and she's healthy and she's finally being able to show people and play the kind of tennis that, like she said, as a junior, she got injured and she was the second best Czech player. And then she got forgotten about. A bit like, I remember Del Potro said that when he won the US Open, he got injured, everyone just sort of forgot. And she said it was really hurtful because she had gone from being number two and talked about to no one was interested at all.
And, yeah, and that's what happens.
And it seemed like her body is something she said at Indian Wells, she's continually going to have to be careful with it and monitor it a bit more than others. But it's really nice to see her fit and healthy and playing like that.
Yeah, I always thought that you need like two full seasons to see sort of really where you can get to. I don't know actually whether Mukova's ever had that. to be honest.
No, I don't think she has.
She's probably at about a season now. So yeah, will be really interesting. I think, you know, she's obviously good on the grass, so she's got a lot of potential there. It's always hard to back up a final, especially when it's a bit of a breakthrough. But yeah, I mean, the thing in terms of people forgetting about you, people only remember what you've done, not what you could have done. It doesn't really matter what the reason is. You know, you think about Monica Seles, for example, what she could have achieved is absolutely bonkers. What she did achieve was bonkers. But, you know, when you look at numbers, it pales in significance in terms of the amount of slams, etc., because of everybody else that's come since.
Oh, there was a thud and you disappeared. I'm hoping you're still there.
Drop my phone.
It's what you were saying. It suddenly went bang. I was like, is that the end? Is this the end that you've been? Is this the end that you've been?
It's a mic drop.
I am conscious that I don't want you to talk too much because then you might start sending me pictures of your tonsils that I just don't want to see. So we're onto the grass because tennis doesn't stop and suddenly we're on the grass. I happened to be at Wimbledon yesterday and it's lovely because no one there. Well, there's people there, but there's, you know, relatively no one there. And it's green and it's calm and the flowers. And you just think, I do love the clay. Oh, but you get to the grass, you're like, I just think I did lots of deep breathing and thinking, oh, this is lovely. So that was nice. And I thought, gosh, it doesn't stop. And we move on. So let's do our yearly. What's going to be the biggest challenge for players, clay to grass, especially those not as natural or with not as much experience on the grass? What are the biggest challenges for the next few weeks?
Well, get low, as I say every year.
Yeah. Yeah, it's important to repeat.
That's it. Although, I must say, I had a little hit on the grass at All England Club. It is very firm. It's not It's not like it used to be. I mean, you used to go on the grass and you would feel under so much time pressure that you felt like you had to take your racket back before your opponent even hit the shot. Like, you just have to guess. They're probably going to my forehand. I'm just going to try. It was just that. You just had no time to react because it was so slick. And it has got harder and harder every year. And it just didn't really feel like that. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be slow, but it feels slow because you're expecting it to really shoot through so much more. So, so I don't know whether, in terms of the expectations of playing on the surface, are necessarily the same as they always have been. I mean, of course, it's going to maximise a certain type of player that, or there are types, multiple of player that it can maximise. But I mean, you've got players that are desperately looking to get as many matches as possible on the grass. That's the big thing. It's the short turnaround. You've got somebody like Djokovic who says, I'm only going to play Wimbledon, and that's fine.
And he normally does an exhibition, doesn't he? There's a Boodles, a couple of little things he can pop up at and just get on the grass.
Yeah, but really, he'll just back himself that, yeah, he'll work his way into the tournament. I mean, it's now is the time that players are really just trying to see how they're shaping up on the grass. You're getting some huge wins as well for players as people come from the French Open and they just get their feet on the grass and they're not playing well. I saw Azarenka lost earlier today. Andy Murray won the Challenger. Did he win the Challenger? He won the Challenger, didn't he?
Yep.
It's just a completely different phase. And it's just, I think the biggest thing, even though we've got an extra week now, is sort of hilarious because it's just so quick. It's just really hard. Yeah. If you're not winning matches, you are not getting time on the grass. You just, you know, yeah, sure, you can practice, but it's not the same. And if you keep losing first round, you know, that's the thing. Yeah, you know, but people might go, oh, Andy's won a challenger, so what? But he's just played four or five matches on grass. That's the point.
It's the grass. It's the matches. It's the wins. And the next few weeks, we'll talk about it loads. I think we're not going to be physically together to Wimbledon. And then, as we know, we'll be shifted on different matches at the far ends of Wimbledon. So we're not even going to be anywhere near each other. But we'll physically be in the same location. So I'm looking forward to that. We'll save predictions. I've got the boys' birthday party this Saturday, which I am preparing. Lots and lots of 7-8-year-olds. Football party. It's going to be hot. I'm going to have to spray them with sun cream every opportunity, cover them in water. It's can you hear the stress in my voice building?
You sound so excited.
Oh, And then today, one of the twins, we got to school and his best friend was there, and he said, "Mummy, just wondering, can I have a play date with my best friend?" And I was like, "When?" He said, "After the party." And I felt like saying, "You are kidding me. After the party, when everyone's gone, I want to sit down with a drink and just in a dark room and recover." So I was like, "Oh, let's think about it. Shall we think about it? Oh, lovely. Okay, have a nice day at school." So, yeah, I've got that this Saturday. So I'm gearing up. Party bags are ready. That's the most important thing that anyone cares about, by the way. So be very okay. good with your party bags party when the time comes. Party bags are very important. So I've got that this weekend. So back from the clay, a brief moment on the grass, boy's birthday, and then grass all the way until the end of this very short spell.
Grass, grass, grass.
It's so grass, exciting. Grass, grass, grass. It's very exciting. I look forward to more of your very excitable voice notes, and we'll and we'll pod again soon.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.